Far away. Okay, good afternoon. So last week we delivered a budget that's important for the future of New Zealand. I think most New Zealanders are realistic about what needs to be done to get our finances back in good shape and to return to surplus so we can start repaying debt. The government's finances are already moving in that direction themselves. The budget should be seen in the context of the government's three-year program. In 2008, we inherited forecasts showing permanent deficits and ever-rising debt, net debt soaring to 60% of GDP by 2023. Over successive budgets, we have kept improving that outlook and at the same time protecting the most vulnerable and investing in a large number of growth initiatives. Budget 2011 gets us back to healthy surpluses within 4 years. It takes several measured and balanced decisions to do this, while also providing $5.5 billion to help for the rebuild of Christchurch. There have been some commentary about the Treasury's budget forecasts for jobs and growth, suggesting they are too optimistic. I'd like to make two comments about that. First, Treasury's independent forecasts are in the pack of other forecasts. In fact, a number of them have described the budget forecasts as conservative. Remember, Treasury is forecasting 1.8% growth in the year ending March 2012 year and 4% growth in the year ending March 2013. That is not aggressive compared with previous recoveries. And if I was just to have a look briefly at the forecast comparisons that other banks have got, ANZ says, we think the Treasury has been a bit conservative in this regard. We see upside risk to the tax revenue numbers. BNZ says, we can thus get the growth forecast by Treasury needed to achieve the revenue objectives. The answer, probably, our forecasts for economic growth are not significantly different to Treasury. Deutsche Bank says, these forecasts are a little weaker than our own, and thus a prudent base for the government's fiscal planning. Goldman Sachs says, overall, Treasury's economic forecasts are broadly similar to our own. Westpac says, if anything, the Treasury's economic assumptions seem fairly conservative. So moving on to the second point, and that is that there are many reasons to be optimistic about New Zealand's prospects. We have the highest commodity prices in a generation. Our exports are switching strongly towards fast-growing Asia. Interest rates are the lowest in 45 years, and Christchurch rebuild will soon be underway. So I believe we have set a very strong platform for growth, more jobs and higher incomes over the next few years. Contrast our program to Labor's. They are on a complete tangle. They've criticised every government move to reduce spending while promising to spend billions more on their own expensive programs. The latest was this weekend where they vastly underestimated the cost of reintroducing the R&D tax credit and at the same time hitting families with higher milk, cheese and meat prices by ramping up the ETS costs on farmers. Overall, Labor's plans aren't credible and will mean billions of dollars of more debt. And just briefly on that number, if we would use a scaled-down version of Labor's plan in 2008, where they had a 15% tax credit proposed, if we scale that back to 12.5%, using their own numbers, the cost is roughly $1.55 billion. They're bringing farming into the ETS theoretically 2 years earlier, so therefore they gain revenue of $355 million, which leaves them about $1.2 billion in the hole. So even before they got off the blocks on Sunday, they have misrepresented to the New Zealand public the cost of their program to the tune of $1.2 billion. So hopefully with a bit of practice they'll get better at this, but their first attempt is not that flash. In terms of ministerial activity, tomorrow I'm in Wellington for various events. On Wednesday I'm at Trends in Queenstown, Friday I'm in Auckland, and on Saturday, Sunday, the Party's Northern Regional Conference in Auckland.
So
that's always the risk, but what we've said though, of course, is that we're going to review that, and there's a review being undertaken at the moment. We've also put a caveat on that, saying we'll only bring agriculture in if it's consistent with what we see from other producers around the world. And that's, at this point, we're not seeing a lot of movement in other countries. In fact, if New Zealand was to come into the ETS for agriculture in 2013, we'd be the only country in the world doing that.
So it sounds as though it's not likely at all that you're going to bring agriculture into the ETS.
Well, it's not guaranteed, as I say, for two reasons. A, we've got the review, and we'll know that the whereabouts of that review, or we'll have that review to hand in the middle of July, I think late July. But also, we are very conscious of the international competitiveness of our export sector. It's our largest export earner. It accounts for a lot of the potential growth in the agricultural sector in New Zealand, and we think our farmers should be competitive. We also think they are actually effectively paying via the ETS already. I mean, farmers are large users of electricity, large users of petrol and diesel and the like, so to argue that they're not paying something towards emissions trading at the moment is simply not correct.
They're not paying their proportionate share though, and that comes back to the argument of how fair it is that effectively the general householder that.
Well, I think we've got to look and see why we have an emissions trading scheme. I mean, for a start, it's actually to reduce emissions, and that means that someone can mitigate their emissions by doing something different. If we simply just put another big fat tax on farming, then how can they actually mitigate their costs? Now, we think through petrol and diesel and electricity, they can work to be more efficient, but simply in terms of their output, well, it's not easy for them to reduce their emissions, short of shooting productive animals. Now, if that's Labor's policy, that's an interesting policy, but I don't think that's right.
But, again, I suppose on the fairness, householders are expected to mitigate these, and obviously it's on a smaller scale. Why shouldn't the same obligation be put on the producers who are actually increasing or you know, making us liable for those ETS charges?
Because householders, and in fact other manufacturers and the likes, have options. They can insulate their home, they can use another form of fuel, they can use energy saving devices. I mean, a farmer, if you're going to put an emissions trading scheme on them for the emission of methane and nitrate gases that come from the burping and farting of animals, when there's no other option, it's pretty tough on them. Now, we're working on nitrate inhibitors, we're working aggressively through the Global Alliance in terms of trying to solve those issues, we're working in terms of scientific research, but the Labor Party is simply saying, I'm going to put a big fat tax on farming early and I'm going to use it to fund something else which is independent. And that's actually not the right correlation, even if they could get their numbers right and they haven't done that.
It may well appeal, though, to New Zealand families who feel that they're subsidising farmers as a political message or a policy.
Sure. And now the same New Zealand families that will pay more when they go and buy their meat and their butter and their milk and their cheese.
Andrew Carey has apparently told Mr. Gough that the position of the ETS on agriculture, across agriculture fully, will not impact prices for dairy products. And if we look at the likely impact of the ETS on, for example, the milk supply payer, that's a few cents compared to the fluctuations that we've seen in international prices.
So let's take a step back and wind back the clock to when we bought the emissions trading scheme in, under National, I think in 2009-10. Does anyone remember Federated Farmers out there campaigning against it aggressively? I mean, the reason for that is we need to understand what an emissions trading scheme does, and it adds a cost onto productive activity. Now, we do that to try and send the right price signal, and if we see that in terms of, let's take electricity, putting a price on carbon makes sense because we're actually seeing new generation in the area of renewable energy because it's pricing at an advantage, renewables, over fossil fuels which emit greater emissions. So our point is simply, you can't just add costs on the farm and not say that over time costs would rise to consumers. They have to. In the case of Fonterra at the moment, they've got a price cap when it comes to milk in New Zealand because they are making good profits on the international market, taken to the extreme. I mean, ultimately, if New Zealand exporters, which are the large part of the export markets, eventually got priced out of the market, then global supply would reduce and global prices would rise. Otherwise, why can't we put any old price on the farm? So from National's perspective, we're simply saying we think we've got that balance about right, but the purpose of the review and the purpose of having a caveat that it's got to be around the, ensuring that we don't price our farmers out of the market is to make sure that they're internationally competitive.
Bill Gough said today that some families simply can't live on the minimum wage of $39 an hour.
Well, it's very difficult for some families on the minimum wage. We acknowledge that. And that's why you have a Working for Families tax credit that actually isn't just giving back the tax that those families pay, it's actually giving them a net cash supplement. That is why in Budget 2011 we were very careful to make sure that the payments to those families actually went up. When someone on the minimum wage, their family payments went up. So again, if we could just legislate to make wages higher with no implications on the economy, in other words, people not losing their jobs or not an implication for others who are buying goods and services, why don't we legislate for the minimum wage to be $20? Now, I think there's a balancing act here. We as a government have taken the minimum wage from $12 to $13. We've done that in difficult economic conditions. But Phil Goff is the person that's been saying unemployment is too high, particularly for young people. Department of Labour advice is the minimum wage goes to $15, 6,000 people lose their job. Phil Goff is saying that the price of the cost of living is rising and it's hard on those low-income families. He's proposing to put the price of their staples up. No, because an R&D tax credit isn't a capped level of expenditure, it's a deductible or allowable expenditure. So if lots and lots of companies go out there and say this is now R&D spending, it will be subject to a 12.5% rebate. It's unlimited. And in fact, when we looked at it and when we came into government and inherited that policy, one of the reasons why we rejected it and came up with a different policy on the campaign trail was the advice we had from the major accounting firms in New Zealand is that the big winner from an R&D tax credit is the accounting firms and actually companies who can change the allocation of expenditure. It's actually not research and development. In fact, you may well get less research and development taking place.
So you believe it's impossible to cap it?
Well, you can't cap it. By definition, it says anybody who undertakes a permissible activity gets a 12.5% credit. And under their own numbers, last time when it was 15%, it was costing $373 million after a few years. Just scale that back to 12.5%, you're at about $315 million. So you add up the numbers, they're $1.2 billion short of what they need. And that's typical of their programs. They did that with Working for Families, they did it with interest-free student loans, they did it with KiwiSaver. Every major program they've had, they've grossly underestimated the cost, and Nationals had to come in and actually tidy that up. And that's what the last 3 years have been about.
Wasn't it Treasury who grossly underestimated the cost of it?
Well, it's also the Labor Party because they were the ones who were out there saying that the numbers would cost that. And you might remember back in 2005, we actually had to go to the Ombudsman, and the Ombudsman at the very last moment released the costings because Treasury's costings were significantly higher than what actually the Labor Party was saying student loans would cost, because I remember having that fight with Michael Cullen and Trevor Mallard. And in fact, even then, Treasury still got the estimates wrong.
Can I take a look at the minimum wage for a second?
Yep.
Some gossip is that business can absorb the $2 extra now that Labor would raise minimum wage to 15. What do you think about that?
Well, if it's just as simple as that, and saying to those thousands of businesses around the country that you can afford to pay that extra $2, I think a lot of businesses would do it. They want to keep their staff, they want to look after them, but there's a balancing act here. It's been thin margins for a lot of businesses. They're not making a huge amount of money. And we try to get that balance about right. I mean, we've raised the minimum wage in very difficult conditions from $12 to $13. But I, for one, am not prepared to send 6,000 people to the dole queue. And that's what aggressively raising the minimum wage will do. I mean, in the end, governments have tried for years to actually legislate wages. And that's not terribly effective. The most effective way is to have a high productive economy. And that means you have to have a good skill set, you have to have the right tax system, you have to have the right investment infrastructure, you have to have the right global outlook, you have to have the right size government. But this is not as simple as just clicking your fingers and saying we want. Because what's magical about $15 other than the Unite Union a while ago that thought it was a good idea? I mean, if we get to $15, will it be $20 or $25? I mean, we want the minimum wage to go up, but it's got to go up in a way which is affordable for everyone and doesn't put at risk those New Zealanders who want to get a job.
Just on another story, Pharmac, we've had US senators bring their name to opposition to TPP. Obviously, it's been an ongoing bone of contention, but are you coming under more pressure? Is the government coming under more pressure over Pharmac now? And how committed is the New Zealand government to protecting farmers?
We're in the process of a negotiation when it comes to TPP. And the government's view is a successful completion of the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be beneficial on balance to the New Zealand economy. Now, there are individual component parts of laws being negotiated, and I'm not going to set bottom lines on those today. What I can say is that New Zealand won't sign up to an agreement unless it believes it's overall in New Zealand's best interest to do so. There will always be some give and take in every agreement and every relationship that we have, and you'll have that on the agricultural side internationally, just as there are other requests coming out. But I'm not going to go through the individual parts of that. Let's just see how the process goes, and let's see how successful we can be.
FarmAC's not a bottom line.
Well, look, we think FarmAC has been hugely successful. We think it makes money for New Zealanders, the most cost-efficient way of purchasing pharmaceuticals for New Zealanders, and we would take a fair bit of convincing that wasn't the right model. But, you know, rather than get into an adversarial relationship or negotiation played out through the media, I'd rather allow our negotiators to have some freedom to have the negotiations, and they'll periodically report back to the government. All I can say is we're not going to do something that's not in New Zealand's best interest.
So it would be quite difficult to show, wouldn't it, that, for example, if you lost the savings that FarmAC delivers through what it does, a tangible benefit that would make up that direct savings?
Well, let's wait and see. There's a lot of component parts here. I mean, we're talking about access through a free trade agreement to arguably the largest economy in the world. And that's the prize if you can complete a USFTA, which is what TPP is.
That story that ran in the Sunday Star Times about
the
GCSB.
Is that true? Well, look, I mean, all I can tell you is I don't comment on security issues, but I don't believe everything I read in the Sunday Star Times either.
So there hasn't been a minister with a
thumb. Well, I don't comment on security issues, but I don't believe everything I read on the Sunday Star Times.
For the
Yes.
Have
Oh, we haven't formally yet. I mean, someone asked me today. I mean, all I can say is one of the front runners is Christine Lagarde. I mean, I met her when I was on the trip to Paris. She seemed, you know, very, very competent. She's got a tremendous reputation, so she is clearly one candidate, but there may well be others.
So she's not necessarily somebody that you're saying New Zealand.
Well, we're not in that position at that point, but at some point we will be, but, yeah, we're not at this point. Well, there's been no formal request for him to come to New Zealand. So, you know, if that is the case, then we'll consider that. There's a number of things that you, in fact, would have to consider, and in the process of putting together some advice for me. But at this point, there's been no formal request.
Why was it necessary to pass legislation under urgency?
Well, you always pass legislation anyway as a result of the budget to reaffirm the tax rates. Secondly, we've laid out our program, and we've set out our program quite clearly, and I think it makes sense to legislate for that program. But the program, in terms of the changes we made, have no impact until post the government. So the members' tax credit, as an example, is paid as a yearly payment. We've made three yearly payments. The fourth yearly payment we'll make is if we're the government at the end of June July in 2012. So if a future government other than ours wanted to come in and change that, they're free to do so, and there'd be no impact on New Zealand's KiwiSaver accounts.
Just, it's true that entitlement to the members' tax credit accrues at the lower rate from July.
Well, no, it's paid on a yearly basis. So we pay the 2011 payments in July of 2011. So they're paid yearly, and this year that's why we're paying $1.1 billion. Next year, if we're the government, we'll pay about $650 million.
I think Adam's point is that on an accrual basis, you can count that $500 million towards meeting your zero target for the year.
Well, all I can tell you is this year in the accounts, we take $1.1 billion worth of cost. That's what we pay out. We pay it on a yearly basis. So we pay the 9, 10 and 11 payments in July of each of those years. So again, if someone wants to be a different government and propose a different model, they can change the law and there'll be absolutely no impact on New Zealand's KiwiSaver accounts.
The rate at October this year will be maximum
No, it's not. It doesn't work that way. I mean, basically what happens is there is a payment made on an annual basis, and the next annual payment will be made in July of 2012.
For the year from July 2012.
Yeah, but it's an annual payment. That's the way it works.
Just in terms of the ETS.
Someone can change it. If Labor want to come in, reverse the members' tax credit, they're welcome to do so. The amount that will go in the account will be whatever they change it to.
In terms of the ETS, you say there is a danger that prices could rise.
Correct.
Once National's scheme comes in.
Well, that's always the risk, actually, of any ETS, and the question is just whether it apportions relative fairness and whether it addresses your other issues. I mean, one of the aims behind an emissions trading scheme is not to actually necessarily apportion cost, but it's to change behaviour. And we're seeing that. We're seeing a move away from fossil fuels for electricity generation. We're seeing an increase in forestry planting. So we're seeing a change in behaviour. What I'm saying is, National doesn't see the ETS as a money-making device. It sees it as a way of changing behaviour and meeting our international obligations. Labor are basically saying, we'll just whack any old tax on and we'll use it to fund anything we want.
Yeah, but my question was going to be, if the domestic dairy sector was more competitive, do you think that price would be lower?
Well, taken to the extreme, ultimately, I mean, what drives conversion and supply on the farm is return. So we've seen that over the last 20 years, people moving out of sheep farming into dairy farming because the return has improved in dairying and it's decreased in sheep farming. So yes, by definition, given New Zealand is such a large exporter relative to the international market, if we are more competitive, then we export more.
No, but domestically, you're worried about domestic prices at the moment in this
That's
session.
Right.
So if the New Zealand dairy industry domestically was more competitive, if it wasn't just Fonterra supplying most of the milk, then that price rise wouldn't be as much, and perhaps we could go ahead with the ETS.
Well, I mean, what drives competitiveness is, you know, an interesting issue, but the Dairy Industry Restructuring Act has always had provisions in it to allow there to be some domestic competition. On balance, we've decided a single desk seller, you know, in for the majority of the milk internationally has been in New Zealand's best interest. And that's why we allowed Fonterra to be have an exception from the Commerce Commission, but be subject to Dairy Industry Restructuring Act.
You're not very enthusiastic about agriculture doing these years, are you? It's probably not.
Well, what I'm saying is it has to meet those conditions, and that is, you know, I don't think you can throw our biggest export earner to the wolves. So if other countries are going to step up and do their bit, sure, then New Zealand should do its bit. But not in isolation, and certainly not in 2013. There's no chance of other countries expecting their agricultural sector to do that by 2013.
What do you think the current prospects are of any other countries stepping forward, and is there a certain number of countries that would be required, or would one be enough?
Well, in 2013, I think it's very low. But, I mean, let's see. I mean, in Australia, you know, they're working towards putting a price on carbon. We've always wanted to have a relative position with Australia. But as we can see, just how hard fought that battle is across the Tasman.
So should our second and third and fourth biggest export owners also be exempt from the ETS? Why is it just our single biggest export?
Well, that's the reason why we give them credits up to their 1990 base. And that is why we try and allow them to have those credits to work their way through changing their behaviour. My point is that I'm not opposed to expecting our New Zealand producers, or whatever it might be, to change their behaviour. And as I say, I think a price on carbon works. I support that. I think New Zealand's done the right thing having emissions trading scheme. But it's always been about people's ability to mitigate and change.
Incentive is on the agricultural sector if you say that, like, we're not going to impose it on them unless they can cope with it. Doesn't that remove the incentive for them to change, because there's no imperative for them to do so? It's like, oh, I've got another 5 years and, you know, maybe that's not going to happen even then. You know,
I'm not saying the test is not that they can cope with it. The test is whether other countries join them.
Yeah, but that all ties them together. I mean,
no, it doesn't.
You're talking about competition if you're imposing costs.
Well, we don't live in some magical little world where New Zealand can impose whatever costs it wants and say that has no impact on our ability of our exporters to compete. We already have the only unsubsidised agricultural sector in the world. And you don't see our farmers moaning about that, and nor do you see any political will to change that. I'm simply saying that they've got to have a reasonable chance of this. Now, I think they can.
This price incentive, if it keeps getting, you know, if there's no sort of set deadline.
There is a deadline, but there's also a caveat, and that caveat's been there, and that's the purpose of the review.
So what?
Not the deadline, it's a qualified deadline.
That's right, and it's a qualified deadline.
Exactly. So what isn't the point of emissions trading, whether at the Kyoto level or the national level, that you don't have to, take financial responsibility for your emissions? If someone else can cut emissions more cheaply than you can, that's fine, you buy credits from them. But it is
sorry.
A financial obligation on emitters that's related to their emissions, whether or not they have cheap options for reducing their own emissions.
That's right. But I think we also have to say we're in a very interesting space when it comes to what's happening internationally. I mean, no one knows what's going to happen in terms of CP2, although there's, you know, a high degree of scepticism that there will be a CP2. So what we do know is that countries are working on a variety of different options of how to deal with a post-Kyoto period, if indeed there can't be an agreement in South Africa this year or later in the year. And I'm simply saying, from New Zealand's point of view, I think we do have to price carbon. I think we did the right thing when we brought it in the areas that we did. And, you know, I'm happy to continue down the pathway of an emissions trading scheme that covers all sectors, but it has to be in a position where New Zealanders can cope. And, you know, New Zealand at the end of the day is 0.2% of world emissions. We can't win this thing on our own. We need every country to be involved. Okay, thanks so much.